is the famous Aleppo boy.
Yeah.
You can see his eyes, he's completely dissociated. No.
What is that about?
Pardon?
What is that about?
Syria.
The Aleppo boy, this is Syria. This is a child that was recovered from the bombing in Syria. He's on his way to the hospital in an ambulance. He's lucky that he's on his way to the hospital. I don't know what happened to him. But here's another image of the orphan. If we have a trauma history, this is a figure that's going to show up in our unconscious. This is an ancient tomb figure from Egypt. Portrays a child sitting alone, naked, thin, knees pulled up, contracted in grief or shame, and conveys a sense of intense mourning by one who is bereft, one of the meanings of the Greek word orphanos, the orphan. Other meanings are without parents, fatherless, desolate, dark place, deserted by everyone, a loss of primary foundation of support. And the image of the orphan evokes our compassion, especially because of its link with the young, helpless, and with innocence. Now, in mythology and in Jung's writings, there's always something sacred about the orphan. And that's the really interesting thing. Something soulful clings to this image, and this may have to do with the fact that although the orphan is rejected and abandoned by its human parents, it often finds itself parented by nature itself, by animal parents. Romulus and Remus are parented by wolves. The orphan may be sustained by these resources from the unconscious itself or from nature itself. Now, Jung was very interested in that fact, and I talked earlier in my first lecture about how Jung really felt clearly that individuality had a sacred and a spiritual basis. His complicated way of saying it is that individuality has an a priori unconscious existence. The same is true with the orphan. And Jung got so interested in the orphan that he used it on his stone in Balingen. He believed very clearly that the suffering of the orphan and its connection with the deeper realities of support in nature made the orphan an image of humanity itself, of all of our history. There's something orphaned in all of us. And he used imagery from alchemy when he carved his stone in Balingen. And here's what he wrote. I just want you to hear this imagery about the orphan. I am an orphan, alone. Nevertheless, I am found everywhere. I am one, but opposed to myself. I am youth and old man at one and the same time. I have known neither father nor mother, because I have had to be fetched out of the deep like a fish, or fell like a white stone from heaven. In woods and mountains I roam, but I am hidden in the innermost soul of man. I am mortal for everyone, yet I am not touched by the cycle of eons. Cycle of eons of time. So, I want to, concerned about showing the two sides of the child archetype. And what I'm going to take you through briefly in a moment is the universal symbolic significance of the child. Because it's not just, we have to go beyond, and Jung is very helpful in this, we have to go beyond thinking about the child only as our injured orphan child. And we have to learn about the child when it comes up in dreams with people we're working with or in our own lives as something that symbolizes something more. And so it's that something more that I want to try to look at now. And in recovering the orphan, I think we are recovering our orphan capacity to feel. So if you get this formulation, you will get everything I've come here to talk about. And I can save this slide for you to photograph later if you'd like, but I'm going to read it now. Recovery of the orphan is equivalent to a recovery of our capacity to feel, and this recovery always seems to carry spiritual significance. When the channel for feeling is opened and the child returns, something we call a soul also comes to presence. When we embrace our broken hearts, we discover we're embracing an orphan child with a broken heart within. And clinging to this orphan is something of our own lost innocence, our pre-traumatic wholeness, our eternal inheritance, returning to us from out of the unconscious where it has been miraculously preserved under the spell of angels. Now, sometimes at the darkest time, this child is born under its own star in a Bethlehem of the body. Its reemergence brings new life and hope. If this child lives to maturity, it will remind us that we belong to two worlds. We will be able to say to it, with Jung, I went on the way of the day, and you went invisibly with me. You upheld my belief when I was alone and near despair. At every decisive moment, you let me believe in myself. Now that's Jung's dialogue with his own divine child that came to him in the Red Book. And you don't get there unless you go through the pain first. I mean, sometimes you do. Sometimes there's a burst of light and an epiphany, and we'll talk about a couple of those moments when we go into the darker parts of this talk. But so there are two children, there are two angels. We're a dual unity. Now here's the divine child. This is Della Notte's image. You notice the wings on the angels on the left? This is a child attended by the light angel. And you notice where the light's coming from. Yeah, the child is the source of light. Now, this is Catherine Asper's quote, and this has to do with the divine child, which is what comes to the orphan. From time immemorial, throughout the world, the child has been the bearer of our deepest longings and highest ideals. Holiness, innocence, harmony, happiness, pleasure and joy, peace and eternity, all are equally projected onto the child. And he appears in art, literature, mythology, and religion as a being blessed with all the characteristics of divinity. The child symbol mirrors not outer reality, but the inner reality of the psyche, and reflects the wishes, hopes, and longings to which we aspire. Thus, the child becomes a symbol for that which is new and yet to come. Okay, so the child archetype is the most important archetype in all of Jung's work. If you want to read one thing by Jung, I would recommend The Archetype of the Child. It's in volume 8. And I will quote a few things from him. But remember, Jung was a pastor's son. He couldn't stand what he was getting every Sunday from his preacher father. And yet, he felt that the instinctive truth in the whole Christian story. So he had to find a way of revisioning Christian story. And the idea of a child born with a dual destiny, with a dual parentage, divine and human, is what set him on the path of what he called his holy path, his holy journey. And when he discovered that all the child gods are born of one divine and one human parent, he said, oh, this must be an archetype or something. In other words, these are are universal themes that are outpictured in the mythologies of the world. And so the great heroes, the great avatars of the future and the redemption for humanity always straddle those two worlds. So that's the core of Jung's discoveries. Now here's an image that's over 3,000 years old. It's one of the oldest images we have of the divine child. A newborn god here dances on the top of a lotus. It's a little hard to see. The lotus is in blossom. Two female deities accompany him with the music of, or her, with the music of sistrum and cymbals. This relief decorates the column of a birthing house, a temple dedicated to the divine child. In the early Egyptian religion, the lotus played a significant role as an image of the birth of the bud of consciousness. And it came from the primordial waters of the unconscious as it emerges. Because the opening and closing of the blossom follows the rising and setting of the sun, the lotus is often a solar symbol. Beverly Moon writes for Aras, the Encyclopedia of Archetypal Symbolism, the following. The child is a universal symbol of the unknowable but latent possibilities of the future, together with the concrete, specific inheritance of the past. So there would be the orphan child. A reminder of both, the child, most importantly, symbolizes the present moment, the wonder, receptivity, and freshness of consciousness that is open to the here and now. The divine child is often depicted in close connection with the powers of nature, especially the waters. The child born of the lotus is also a newborn sun, emergent consciousness. And then she writes, the archetype of the child has to do with the wonder of all beginnings and the wonder of all beginning again. We are led by it to imagine being in the world as on the first day of creation, seeing the world for the first time. The child embodies and encourages spontaneity, joy, imagination, celebration. But as we've noted in the earlier lectures, the divine child rarely comes up in mythology without daimonic guardians, protectors, and persecutors, right? And sometimes these persecutors even try to kill the child. Remember how upset King Herod was when Jesus was born? Well, that's a universal story. The child interrupts the old order and threatens the old kingship. So Herod sends his minions out to kill all the 2-year-olds and under. Now, these efforts on the part of the dark angel in the system, what I call the self-care system, to kill the soul child are not really an effort to annihilate it altogether. Because where would this be without the child? Right? He'd be undoing himself. So his efforts are to kill the connections between the child and the functioning ego, the surviving ego. Instead of death or annihilation, we often see in the myths, for example, the child has to go into exile. Back into the unconscious where it lives is sort of in suspended animation until sometime in the future when it can reemerge from its prison and come back into life. Now the work of collecting all the relevant myths that portray this more than personal child and his mythology have been done for us by Otto Rank. And here's what Rank says. These are the features of the myth of the lost and recovered child in world mythology. First, the infant is born of noble or divine parents, or a combination of human and divine parents. His origin is frequently preceded by difficulties, barrenness or depression in the land. Two, there are extraordinary signs and prophecies which attend the pregnancy of the mother of this child. For arousing anxiety in the old order, the ruling king or father who vowed to kill the child. Third, the infant is exposed to die or miraculously escapes this death sentence. And finally, the infant is rescued and brought up in another land. He returns and brings enlightenment or renews the community, sometimes overthrowing the old order and its father, its ruling principle. So let's have a look at the miraculous birth. Let me quote Jung here. He says, this is from his essay on the Divine Child. The various child fates may be regarded as illustrating the kind of psychic events that occur in the entelechy or genesis of the self, capital S. The entelechy, that's the unfolding, emergence. The miraculous birth always tries to depict the way this genesis is experienced. Since it is a psychic genesis, everything must appear non-empirically. That is, by means of a virgin birth, or by miraculous conception, or by birth from unnatural organs. The motif of insignificance of this child, exposure, abandonment, orphanhood, and so forth, always tries to show how precarious is the psychic possibility that the child represents, which is new life and wholeness. The enormous difficulties to be met with attaining this highest good. So here are just a few images from world mythology. Okay, this you recognize as the Annunciation, right? This is Poussin's Annunciation and Immaculate Conception. The winged angel is delivering the news. You know, there's a book at the Met, which was put there by a colleague in New York, who went into the imagery that was associated with the Annunciation scene. And what she discovered is that the Annunciation, this is very much like Kubler-Ross's Death and Dying, the Annunciation is met by five different attitudes on the part of Mary. One is acceptance. This looks more like acceptance in this image. One is called contrabatur, which is like this. Don't tell me. Right, not me. Another is bargaining with the angel. And I'd forgotten the exact imagery, but this is so interesting that you have these two worlds coming together, and it's very similar to the response to knowledge of one's own death. It's like, oh my God, the world is here. Now what? So you don't accept it right away. Sometimes it takes a lot of work. But Mary accepts it right away, at least in this image. Now here's Mary having a dream about Christ crucified on the tree of life. So what we're looking for here is the miraculous signs and prophecies, the features of this story that are transcend the normal empirical realities, okay? Because that's what got Jung interested. All right, down here is Maya, the mother of the Buddha, having a similar dream, only instead of Christ on a tree, she's visited by a little white elephant with six tusks, who tells her about the future birth of the coming Buddha. Here's another image from the second century. Now, this precedes Christianity by 600 years. The same theme, right? In a dream, a visitation, you are going to give birth to a person, but a person with a dual destiny. Now, here's Maya giving birth to the Buddha through her side. Remember, Jung said, it's got to happen non-empirically. So all the features of this new birth are going to be unusual. Here's Adonis being delivered from the myrrh tree. Myrrh's turned, because of incest with her father, she's turned into a tree, and she finally delivers Adonis, who is a kind of counterpart to nature's beauty. to Venus. And here's Dionysus' second birth from Thigh of Zeus. Okay. Now, all these figures are shown in an unusual birth process. So that, what does this tell us? This tells us that this is an unusual child. This is not a normal, mundane child.